so via the Music Matters page of the Radio 3 website.
Piano Season on the BBC.
On BBC Radio 3, Lunchtime Chopin from four leading contemporary pianists. Captured in recital in London, François-Frédéric Guy, Sergio Tiempo, Nicholas Angelich and Benjamin Grosvenor playing nocturnes, sonatas, etudes, mazurkas, waltzes and much more. Lunchtime Chopin in the Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert, part of the Piano Season on the BBC, Tuesday to Friday from 1 o'clock.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. Thousands of unionists are taking part in a parade through Belfast to mark the 100th anniversary of one of the most significant dates in their history. Nearly 500,000 people signed the Ulster Covenant in 1912, rejecting the idea of a Home Rule Parliament in Dublin. The Sussex schoolteacher who went missing in France with a teenage pupil has said he won't fight extradition back to the UK and is willing to return as soon as possible. Jeremy Forrest disappeared with 15-year-old Megan Stammers more than a week ago. They were found yesterday in Bordeaux. The girl is expected to be reunited with her family today. Eight people are now known to have died in flooding in southern Spain caused by days of heavy rain. Hundreds of people have been evacuated from their homes in the regions of Andalusia and Murcia. Warnings have now been issued for the northeast of the country. Pope Benedict's former butler has gone on trial at the Vatican accused of stealing confidential documents. Paolo Gabriele has previously admitted that he leaked some of the Pope's letters to an Italian journalist. They were published in a book alleging corruption and power struggles at the top of the Roman Catholic Church. Air accident investigators from the UK are heading to Nepal to investigate the plane crash in which seven Britons were killed. The group was on its way to trek in the Himalayas when the plane came down shortly after taking off from Kathmandu. Islamist Al-Shabaab rebels in Somalia have withdrawn from their last urban stronghold, the port of Kismayo. They pulled out after an attack by Kenyan and Somali government forces on the outskirts of the town yesterday. A laptop belonging to a security chief at the National Grid, who used to be an FBI agent, has been stolen from a hotel room. Warren Bamford retired from the US security agency in 2010. National Grid said there was no information on the laptop that could cause a security risk. And the weather, it'll be dry with sunshine in many areas, but there'll be scattered showers in the west and northwest, and cloudier in the northwest later. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one. And time now for today's early music show. Here's Catherine Bott.
Today we're looking at the life and the spectacular rise and fall of a man who in his lifetime was famous for the palatial splendour of his house and nowadays is best remembered for employing Handel as one of his composers in residence and for being the name behind the Shandos anthems. James Bridges, with a Y, was born into the Herefordshire squirearchy in 1673, which makes him 12 years older than Handel. Well, I say squirearchy, but perhaps that useful catch-all word is a bit lazy. His father was actually 3rd Baronet of Wilton Castle, Sheriff of Herefordshire, and 8th Lord Shandos. James, his first-born son, naturally went to Oxford University, where he joined a music club among whose members was Daniel Purcell, younger brother of the more famous Henry.
Thank you.
the sonata in D minor by Daniel Purcell, played by David Munro, Oliver Brooks and Christopher Hogwood. James Bridges, heir to the Earldom of Chandos, married young and wisely in 1695. His bride was his cousin, Mary Lake, who came with a very promising dowry, the manor in Edgware, Middlesex, known as Cannons. And for the next 15 years or so, James and Mary led the life you would expect, begetting children, just two of whom survived infancy, and in James's case, embarking on a political career. 2 years after his marriage, he became Member of Parliament for Hereford, and his forceful personality and administrative skills soon made him rather a favourite of the Duke of Marlborough, who must have recognised a kindred spirit. James rose through the ministerial ranks to become paymaster of the forces abroad during the War of the Spanish Succession, and he used his handsome salary to good speculative effect. By the time he left the job in 1713, he had amassed a fortune of around £600,000. Matching up these sums of money with today's is an inexact science, but it's safe to say he was the equivalent of a multimillionaire. Sadly, by 1712, he was also a widower, but not for long. In 1713, he married the 43-year-old Cassandra Willoughby, also a cousin, and he began the great work of his life, transforming the Jacobean house at Cannons, the estate that had been part of his first wife's dowry, into a sumptuous Baroque palace. He and his second wife and his two sons moved into their new home in 1714, and later that year, James inherited the Earldom of Carnarvon. The splendour of Cannons was almost unparalleled in England. Handel's biographer John Mannering wrote many years later that one saw much more art than nature and much more cost than art. Among all the costly art was a magnificent organ with a case carved by Grinling Gibbons in the church, an instrument to delight the most discerning musician. Handel, for instance. He didn't write much music for organ, but he did compose 6 fugues or voluntaries for the organ or harpsichord, which were published in 1735. It's thought that they were written some 15 or 20 years earlier, which places them in exactly the right period for Handel to be at Cannons. More on that a bit later. Handel's Organ Fugue in B-flat, played by Leo van Dusselaar. Lord Chandos invited Handel to be his composer-in-residence at Canons in August 1717. Handel's predecessor at Canons was John Christopher Pepusch, later on famous for the Beggar's Opera. But he wrote some charming chamber music too. Here's his pastoral cantata, Corydon, written before he was appointed to his post at Canons, so perhaps this was the music that would have brought him to the attention of the musical Earl of Chandos.
Shade, an echo answer all his strength.
the cantata Corydon by Pepusch, performed by soprano Mona Julsrud with Bergen Baroque. The canon's musical establishment ran to 30 of London's finest musicians and composers, possibly including Francesco Scarlatti, brother of Alessandro. Scarlatti was definitely invited to canons by Chandos, and as one of the Earl's most splendid artistic achievements was the new church of St. Lawrence, the interior a riot of trompe-l'œil and the fashionable grisaille work which depicted biblical scenes. Let's have a Kyrie from a Mass by Francesco Scarlatti.
Thank you.
Christopher Monks directed the Armonico Consort and Concerto Gallese in that Kyrie from a Mass by Francesco Scarlatti. Princely Shandos, as his contemporaries called him, had another nickname, the Apollo of the Arts. It's hard to know, nearly 300 years later, whether these terms were used affectionately or otherwise. He and canons must have inspired a great deal of covetousness. The satirist Alexander Pope sent up the whole conceit, calling canons Timon's Villa in his poem Of Taste. But Daniel Defoe was openly impressed. The palace is so beautiful in its situation, so lofty, so majestic the appearance of it, that a pen can but ill describe it. 'Tis only fit to be talked of upon the very spot. The whole structure is built with such a profusion of expense, and finished with such a brightness of fancy and delicacy of judgment. Shandos had an unfortunate way of falling out with his architects, who numbered 5 in all, including William Talman and James Gibbs, with a little advice from Sir John Vanbrugh. Canons was completed under the supervision of 2 surveyors, and Vanbrugh was not impressed with the whole. The front's V-fine, he noted, but the inside is of poor invention. That poor invention seems to have incorporated much marble and gilt, with royal apartments fronting the parterre and grand canal, finely plastered and gilt, with ceilings painted by Paolucci. From these apartments you go into my lord's dressing room and library. And as for the 105 acres of gardens, they were a riot of what we now have to call water features. Another architect, Nicholas Hawksmoor, who went to mock and stayed to marvel, wrote, "I cannot but own that the water at Canons is the main beauty of that situation, and it cost him dear." We should return to Handel, who remains Shandos's great claim to fame today. After years in Rome and previous lengthy sojourns in London, Handel was back in his native Germany as the Palace of Canons began to rise. But in 1712 he obtained leave from the Elector of Hanover to come to England, on consideration that he engaged to return within a reasonable time, as his biographer Mannering wrote. For the first 3 months, Handel lived in the townhouse of a Mr. Andrews, but he never wanted for rich patrons, and from 1713 to 16 he was the guest of Lord Burlington at Burlington House in Piccadilly. There he was free to compose all day and pleased his patron by playing for him and his friends in the evenings. Life was very civilised, and his work was acclaimed everywhere. The reasonable time after which he was supposed to go back to Hanover came and went. Then, in 1714, Hanover came to him when Queen Anne died, to be succeeded by the Elector of Hanover as King George I. The story has always been that the truant composer was only forgiven by his master after a hastily organised party on the river, at which the new king was so captivated by Handel's music that he restored him to his good books. It didn't happen quite like that. George I actually doubled Handel's pension, and Queen Caroline later raised it again when she appointed him to teach her daughters. But on the 17th of July 1717, there was a royal party on the Thames at which Handel's water music was played. The fountains at Canons were only a month or so away. Thank you. hornpipe from Handel's Water Music Suite in F major, played by the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by Christopher Hogwood. In 1717, Handel wasn't exactly tired of London or tired of life, but maybe he was eager to remove himself from the regal orbit, so when the Earl of Chandos invited him to become the resident composer at Canons, it probably suited him very well to continue his musical life as a grand semi-rural idyll, with occasional visits to his new townhouse in Albemarle Street whenever he needed a few lungfuls of good London air. Certainly the London papers make no mention of Handel between that Thames party of July 1717 and February 1719. In that year, James Bridges, Lord Chandos, Earl of Carnarvon, was created the first Duke of Chandos. Someone sniffily wrote, "for no apparent reason." Life at Canons seemed unstoppably splendid. Handel wrote two English masques during his time at Canons, Haman and Mordecai, which later became the Oratorio Esther, and Acis and Galatea, which was performed at Canons in the spring of 1718 and described by a guest as a little opera. The bucolic "O Ruddier Than the Cherry" from Handel's Acis and Galatea, sung by Alan Ewing with Les Arts Florissants, conducted by William Christie. And then, suddenly, the semi-rural idyll was over. The wealth that had built Canons came from investments in the South Sea Company, and in the spring of 1720 the South Sea bubble burst. Chandos was almost ruined. He lived for another 24 years in very reduced circumstances and even married a third time in 1736, his bride bringing him a useful £40,000 dowry. But the glories of Canons barely survived his death in 1744. His son, the second Duke of Chandos, promptly sold the house and its contents to pay all the family debts, and Canons was demolished in 1747. Architectural salvage was all the rage then, as now, and the original colonnade from Canons can now be seen in front of the National Gallery in London, while its gates are at Trinity College, Oxford. Only the splendid church remains today, and, of course, the musical legacy of Handel at Canons. Handel, who probably had money in the South Sea Company too, removed himself swiftly from Canons when that bubble burst, but not before he had completed the 11 Chandos anthems, especially for performance in the Church of St. Lawrence at Canons. In 1717, his patron wrote to a friend, "Mr. Handel has made me 2 new anthems, very noble ones, and most think they far exceed the 2 first. He is at work for 2 more and some overtures." The Chandos anthems have been described as reflecting the urbane worldliness of 18th-century Anglicanism and the mixture of intimacy and ducal pomp at Canons.
Thank you.
Handel's fourth Chandos anthem, O Sing Unto the Lord, a new song, was sung in that recording by the soprano Lynn Dawson and the tenor Ian Partridge, with the 16 choir and orchestra directed by Harry Christophers. And it ends today's Early Music Show, which focused on the man responsible for Handel's writing that work, James Bridges, the Duke of Chandos. The programme was presented by Catherine Bott and produced by Sam Phillips, and first broadcast in 2008.
Shostakovich's Fourth Symphony. Written and withdrawn during Stalin's Great Terror, it opens the BBC Symphony Orchestra's autumn season. You can hear it live in Radio 3 Live in Concert, Wednesday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
All right, it's time for another chance to hear last Monday's live Wigmore Hall concert. The presenter is Fiona Talkington.
There are few people more passionate about the music of Delius than the cellist Julian Lloyd Webber. He says he feels as though he's known the music forever, inheriting his father's love of it and growing up with the music all around him. In today's lunchtime concert, he's going to play one of the pieces he performed at his Wigmore debut back in 1971, Delius's Cello Sonata. And to mark the 150th anniversary of Delius's birth this year, he and John Lenihan are going to play some of the composer's other works too, his Caprice and Elegy and Romance. Delius's sonata has a close link with Wigmore Hall, premiered here by the young Beatrice Harrison in 1918, and a few years later, she also gave the first performance of the first work on today's programme, a piece written for her, the Cello Sonata by John Ireland. And there's another anniversary. Ireland died 50 years ago this year. It was described after its premiere as one of the most remarkable British works of the kind which has appeared for some time. And for Julian Lloyd Webber, this is certainly one of the cello masterpieces of the 20th century. It's very rewarding to play, technically and emotionally, he says, and very well written for piano too. And Julian Lloyd Webber challenges the common perception that Ireland is a safe and traditional composer. In fact, Ireland's dark side really comes out in this piece. Apparently, the area known as the Devil's Jumps on the Sussex Downs inspired some of the music, and it's a piece of contrasts, turbulence and calm, light and shade, indeed heaven and hell, as Ireland's biographer Muriel Searle put it. And applause now for Julian Lloyd Webber and John Lenihan coming onto the stage here at Wigmore Hall to begin their lunchtime concert for the Cello Sonata in G minor by John Ireland.